Okay, so here are two common views. First class of views I'll call autonomy views. Extremely common in the literature. I'm sure if you've ever read a applied ethics textbook, this would be the kind of view that you'll see. The idea here is that paternalistic interference is wrong because it fails to respect the paternalizee's right to control what happens in their life. So I'm trying to state the view as broadly and all-encompassingly as possible. So on this view, the conception of autonomy in play is something like paternalism is wrong because it offends against the exercise of autonomy. It involves coming between people and their choices. A second view, and I'd say perhaps currently the dominant view in the literature, holds that paternalistic interference is wrong because it's motivated by or expresses the judgment that the paternalizee is potentially incompetent. So, in other words, the paternalizee is somehow deficient in terms of successfully leading their life. And the idea is that acting on or expressing those judgments is disrespectful to the paternalizee, and that explains the distinctive wrong of paternalism. So, in my mind, I like to think of these as the let people do what they want view at the top, and don't call people stupid view down at the bottom. So, one thing to point out is that I think while the autonomy view perhaps captures the idea that paternalism disrespects the exercise of autonomy, you can understand the evaluative view as kind of picking up on a different way of thinking about autonomy and respect. Here, the thought I take it is something like paternalism is wrong because it expresses disrespect for the capacities for autonomous choices rather than the choices themselves. Okay. So I think both of these views are intuitive, both attractive. They both give a very clear explanation of what's going on in our paradigm case that we started with, the case of Bob. So it seems pretty clear that the doctor offends against Bob's autonomy rights, like clearly kind of trammels his interest in controlling what happens in his life. And it also seems that the doctor's action is premised on the belief that, Bob is in some way deficient in terms of living his life well. Seems like the doctor calls Bob stupid in some relevant sense. So despite that, I think both of these views encounter problems. Now, I'm not going to claim that these are kind of decisive objections. The point really is that I think these problems highlight what a better account of the wrong of paternalism should look like, the form it should take. And the problem is, I think both these views run into problems with explaining the difference between what seem like relatively different pairs of cases. So here's an example to pose a problem for the, well, I claim poses an example for the autonomy view. Okay, so this example involves kind of public health or the provision of public goods. And the example goes like this. So imagine we have a community, they inhabit the north bank of a lake from which it draws its drinking water. Members of the community suffer from some non-trivial health condition, let's say just due to genetic bad luck, so there's no kind of wrongdoing going on in the picture. Now imagine there's a public health NGO and it has the option of putting some sort of, rejuvenating supplements in the lake, which will alleviate the health condition. But members of the northern community unanimously reject the health intervention because the supplements contain some substance that their religious commitments prohibit ingesting. Okay, so it seems to me in this case, A, seems like the NGO would act wrongly if they put the supplements in the lake. B, they would treat the northerners paternalistically. And C, at least part of the explanation of why they act wrongly is that they would be treating the northerners paternalistically. And remember, this just is a collective version of the initial case that we started with, the case of Bob, right? Just involves a group rather than an individual. Now, contrast this with a second case. A community inhabits the southern bank of a lake from which it draws its drinking water. Members of the southern community, again, suffer from a serious health condition due to genetic bad luck. Again, a public health NGO has the option of putting supplements in the lake, which will alleviate the health condition. Now, in this case, the southerners unanimously support the health intervention. However, there's another community who inhabit the northern bank of the lake. They do not suffer from the health condition, and they unanimously reject the public health intervention, again, because the supplements contain some substance that their religious commitments prohibit them from consuming. Let's also stipulate that the burden of ingesting that substance is such that the northerners do not have a duty to bear it for the sake of benefiting the southerners. It's not like the northerners would be obligated to sort of put the supplements in the lake themselves, were they able to. And let's also imagine that despite the northerners' opposition, the NGO goes ahead and puts the supplements in the lake. for the sake of the health benefits. Now, I submit that in this case, the NGO perhaps doesn't act wrongly. At least in this case, it seems a lot easier to justify intervention in this case than in the first case. I also think the Northerners, sorry, Northerners, the NGO don't treat anybody paternalistically. I'd be intrigued to see if anyone disagrees with me. So I think there's a clear moral asymmetry between the two cases. And the question is whether the autonomy view can account for that difference. I think the answer is no, or at least it's unclear how that view should do so. And the reason it looks like the sort of relevant bad-making feature that the autonomy view picks out is equally present in both cases, and the good-making features of the action are the same in both cases. So just in a bit more detail, it seems to me that the benefit the NGO provides in each case is of the same magnitude. A community's health condition is equally alleviated. Let's also assume the communities are equally sized. And most relevantly, it looks like, to me at least, the autonomy violation that takes place in order to provide that benefit is equally grave. So in both cases, a non-consensual medical treatment is inflicted on a community's members against their will. It looks like their rights to bodily integrity are equally violated in both cases. It seems to me at the bar of the Northerners' autonomy interests, everything that's done to them in one case is equally done to them in the other case. So it's hard, I think, for the autonomy view to explain what I think is a clear moral asymmetry between the two cases. Here's another problem for autonomy views, which has a similar structure with these pairs of cases. These cases involve paternalistic omissions. So here's a famous example. I think Shauna Shiffrin and Jonathan Kwong have both invoked this pair of cases. Imagine we have Barry. Barry asks Sally to lend him £50. Sally judges that Barry will spend the money imprudently on drugs and sweets, and out of concern for Barry's well-being, she refuses. So this seems, I think, to a lot of people like a clear case of paternalism, and it seems like, I think, Barry has a moral objection to the way that Sally treats him. It seems like a clear case of paternalistic wronging to me and to lots of other people. Now compare this to a second case. Barry again asks Sally to lend him the £50. But Sally would rather spend the money on a treat for herself, and she refuses. I think most people would think that Sally's refusal morally innocuous, certainly not a case of paternalistic wronging. The trouble for autonomy views is to, I think, A, explain what's going on in refusal two, sorry, in refusal one, why this is a case in which the anti-paternalist constraint is engaged, because it doesn't look like Barry has any kind of autonomy-based complaint to what Sally does. She doesn't interfere with him in any way. And the other puzzle for autonomy views is to explain the intuitive difference between the two, because it looks like in both cases, everything is the same at the bar of Barry's autonomy. Right? It looks like if Sally does nothing in the second case, which offends against Barry's autonomy rights, hard to explain what she could be doing in the first case, which so offends. So that's the puzzle. So at this point, you might think, hooray for evaluative views. So it looks like the problem that the autonomy view encounters, I think, in these pairs of cases is that the views focus on, you might say, the effects of paternalism on the target. And these look like pairs of cases where the effects seem very similar. By contrast, evaluative views don't focus on kind of the effects of paternalistic action on the target. Rather, they focus on the reasons that the paternalist acts for. And you might think the evaluative view is well placed to explain the pairs of cases that we've looked at. So in the first case, the public health case, the evaluative view can say, well, look, in the first case, the NGO acts on the basis of some sort of negative, insulting judgment about the Northerners' competence in terms of leading their lives well. In the second public health case, they don't act on the basis of that judgment. So far, so good. Similarly, in the refusal cases, the evaluative view can say, well, look, in the first case, Sally thinks that Barry's an idiot, basically. That's the reason she acts. In the second case, Sally just acts out of self-interest. She has no judgments about Barry's incompetence or competence. So far, so good. Two cheers for the evaluative view. But I think those views run into a structurally similar problem. So here's a variation on our refusal cases. So again, we have refusal one, just as before. Barry asks Sally to lend him 50 quid. Sally judges that Barry will spend the money imprudently on drugs and sweets, and out of concern for Barry's well-being, she refuses. So as we discussed before, seems like a clear case of paternalistic wronging to me and lots of people at least. But now rather than refusal two, compare refusal three. Barry asks Sally to invest in his business venture. Sally judges that the venture would usually be profitable, so she's normally happy to make small loans. But she judges that if she gives the money to Barry, he'll spend it imprudently on drugs and sweets, and as a result will fail to make his business venture a success. Out of concern for her bank balance, she refuses. So it seems to me that first case, clear case of paternalistic wronging, I think refusal three is just like refusal two, not a case of paternalistic wronging. If Barry has a complaint against Sally, I mean, not clear to me that he has any complaint against Sally, certainly not that she's treated him paternalistically, I think. The trouble for the evaluative view is to explain this difference, because in both cases, the reason that Sally acts is that she judges that Barry is prudentially incompetent. He'll spend the money in ways which will set back his well-being. So it seems to me that Sally kind of conditions her interaction with Barry on the basis of an identical judgment about his prudential competence in both cases. So unclear to me how evaluative views are supposed to account for what I think is a clear difference between the two. Okay, so those are my problems with existing views. What does this tell us about the right kind of view? Like, what kind of diagnosis can we offer based on these examples to kind of point us in the right direction? So as I mentioned before, I think all the action is in the reason component of our typical definition of paternalism, the thought that it really matters why the action is justified, whether it aims at promoting the target's well-being or not. And I think the explanation of how we should differentiate the pairs of cases is pretty obvious. What explains the difference is the intervener's end, whether or not our agent acts with the ultimate aim of benefiting their target or not. And this seems to nicely draw the distinction in the intuitively right places. So again, think about the public health one and public health two cases. It's true in both cases that the NGO kind of infringes the autonomy rights of the Northerners. I think the key difference is the ultimate goal that the NGO is aiming at when they do so. In the first case, the Northerners' autonomy rights are infringed for their own sake. In the second case, their rights are equally infringed, but for the sake of somebody else, the Southern community. Again, in the case of refusal one and refusal three, I think we get the intuitively right result here. Even though it's true that Sally has an identical judgment about Barry's prudential competence in both cases, she kind of equally thinks he's a bit of an idiot in both cases. In the first case, she acts because she judges him to be an idiot for his own sake by refusing to give him the money. In the second case, she judges that he's an idiot, but it's the implications of his idiocy on her bank balance, which is what she's aiming at. So I think that's the key difference, the kind of justificatory goal differs. But this now raises, I think, a really interesting and important puzzle. Because it looks like on the view that we're getting to, the wrong of paternalism consists in whether you are motivated or are aiming at the good of the person who you're interfering with. And I think the puzzle here is, how could the kind of beneficence be the wrong-making feature of an action, or non-beneficence a right-making feature? So why does the fact that when you do something to someone and you say, look, I'm doing this for you, like, why is that the wrong-making feature? And when you say to someone, look, don't care about you, I'm just doing this for me, that makes your action right? Now, this is kind of puzzling asymmetry. So I think this is really interesting. I mean, maybe another way of trying to sort of bring out the puzzling nature of what I think is the right form of the anti-paternalist constraint is to kind of compare this with more general discussions in normative ethics about the kind of seemingly puzzling nature of non-consequentialist constraints on promoting the good. So a lot of people have the kind of classic deontological intuition that it's wrong to tell one lie, even if you would thereby prevent two lies from being told. It's wrong to break one person's arm, even if you would thereby bring about, you'd thereby prevent two arms from being broken. And the kind of, you know, the consequentialist puzzlement with these views is, look, like, if you think it's bad that arms are broken, you know, why would morality prevent you from making the world a better place at the bar of what matters? Now, that's puzzling enough. But look, it's worth pointing out, in those cases, the puzzle is something like, how can it be wrong? How can this action be wrong despite the fact you're aiming at making the world a better place? Well, I think it's distinctively puzzling about the anti-paternalist constraint, as I see it, is that the view has to be something like, why can these actions be wrong because, not despite of, in virtue of the fact that you're trying to make the world a better place? So I think it's kind of puzzling the similar reasons, so the way that people find deontological constraints puzzling, but it's got this extra puzzling feature, which is really interesting. And you might think all of this is now grist for the pro-paternalist mill. Someone might say, well, look, you know, I share the kind of classic anti-paternalist intuitions, but, you know, you've convinced me, Jonathan, that once we dig down into it, the kind of the shape of that constraint is super weird. The rationale for it is sui generis and super weird. So, you know, maybe we should just give up on the deontological, give up on the anti-paternalist intuitions we started with. Maybe once we've dug into this deep enough, we just discover that anti-paternalism lacks foundation. Just focus on a view which says, you know, it's fine to do stuff to people, provided it's in their all things considered best interest, something like that. We should give up the idea as a distinctive constraint on paternalistic interference per se. So that's the view of Jason Hanna in his recent book, Defending Paternalism, for example. Okay, cool. So that's the puzzle. So what I'm going to try and do now in the second half of the talk, yeah, half seems about right, is try and meet that challenge, try and prevent a deeper rationale for the anti-paternalist constraint, understood as a constraint on kind of acting for the sake of beneficence, acting for the sake of the target's well-being, which can explain why, even if puzzling, it's nonetheless true. Okay. So here's the proposal in a nutshell. I call it the moral power theory of paternalism, to make it sound more impressive than it is. But it appeals this general phenomenon of moral powers. Some of you may be familiar with this. But in a nutshell, the idea is that we seem to possess abilities to change the moral situation directly via one's willing. So for example, think about the case of consent. There are cases in which people have a duty not to do things to me, but if I consent to their doing it, I thereby change the normative situation. I remove their duty owed to me not to act. Consider the case of promise. I'm not normally bound to do certain things for others, but if I make a promise, I kind of thereby make it the case that I have a duty to act as I promised, which didn't exist before. Final example, consider the case of command. I'm not normally under an obligation to do certain things, but if someone who possesses legitimate authority tells me to do it, it seems like I can incur a moral duty to act as commanded, at least if the background conditions are correct. And I think the most intuitive examples of normative powers tend to concern our bodily and property rights. So it seems pretty intuitive to me that we kind of have authority over our bodies, at least some property. And part of having that authority is having normative powers to kind of change people's rights and duties with respect to those objects. It's normally wrong for people to touch my body without my consent. If I consent, I can make it permissible. Similarly with my property. So starting with those, I think, fairly mundane observations, the proposal is as follows. Just as I find intuitive, each of us has rights to control the use of our bodies and property, what we might call our material resources. We have structurally similar rights to control whether others can use our good, what I'm calling our moral resources. So the idea is that our sovereignty extends not only over the material world, over our bodies and things we rightfully own, but also over kind of parts of the normative world as well. So just to unpack this statement of the view a little bit more carefully, what do I mean by our good in the relevant sense? I mean something like moral reasons for action grounded in a person's well-being. What do I mean by using someone's good? I think you use someone's good if you justify your actions by appealing to the fact it would be good for that person, like you invoke them as a justifying end. And what do I mean by controlling the use of one's good? I mean having at least some measure of, maybe not complete, but some measure of control over the extent to which reasons grounded in one's good stand in a justifying relation to other people's actions. So, you know, standard thought, is my action justified or not? Well, that depends on, you know, whether it benefits, that may depend on whether it benefits other people. My claim is that those people have a degree of control over whether the fact that something will be good for them stands in a justifying relation to my action. But I'll go through this in a bit more detail, and hopefully some examples will make it a bit clearer. So in this view, the idea is that paternalism is wrong in those cases when it is wrong, because it treats people as lacking that distinctive right, the moral power to control the use of their goods, which they in fact have. And the view really has two parts, I think, in explaining the distinctive wrong of paternalism. So the first, what I'm calling the kind of positive part, you know, explains why a kind of a new wrong pops into existence in these cases. So in my view, paternalism involves a directed wrong against the target because it involves unilaterally invoking that person's good as a justification. So that's what the person, the target of paternalism, has a complaint against being invoked in this way. But I think there's also a negative part as well. I think the fact that someone has refused a benefit, and it's, you know, if they're competent and have full information, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, has the result that paternalistic interference with that person is unsupported by the kind of welfarist reasons that would otherwise be available to justify the interference. So by saying, you know, no, thank you, I don't want to be benefited in this case, you kind of block off a class of justifying considerations from speaking in favor of the paternalist action. So just to illustrate that with some of the examples we've looked at, so remember public health one and public health two, let's go back to our normative accounting. The idea is that the key difference between the two cases is that because the Northerners have kind of explicitly rejected the benefit, they kind of blocked off that benefit as a justification for the NGO's action. So even though it may well be true that the benefits are the same in both cases, like the total quantity of good brought about by the NGO is the same in both cases. In the first case, you know, the Northerners have kind of withdrawn that good from the scales, so to speak. So when the NGO acts, they commit a directed wrong against the Northerners because they're trying to use this resource in opposition to the Northerners' will. And also the balance of reasons is different. These reasons are at least kind of partially off the scales, and that explains why, even though the amount of good that's done is the same in both cases, the positive reasons in favor of action are nonetheless different. So there's less good to appeal to here in order to justify putting the supplements in the lake. Second case, by contrast, it's true that the Northerners kind of reject the interference, but the NGO can appeal to a good which is available to them to justify interfering with the Northerners, the good of the Southerners, who, remember, do want to be benefited, so their good is available on the scales in the normal sense. And again, I think my view nicely explains the difference between refusal one and refusal three. Key difference is Sally's ultimate kind of end in acting. In the first case, she acts out of concern for Barry's well-being. In the second case, she just acts out of concern for her own well-being. And that's what explains the difference. Her own well-being perfectly available to her. She can unilaterally invoke that as much as she likes. Barry's well-being, on the other hand, not available for her use in the same way that her own well-being is. And just to kind of clarify the difference between my view and the evaluative views that I discussed a bit earlier, I think the wrong-making feature lies in the red part, not the ultimate, the agent's ultimate end, whereas evaluative theorists focus on the part in green, the kind of the intervener's beliefs about the judgments about the competence of the person they act towards. So that's the key difference. The red, different in the pair of cases, the green, the same. I think my view does well, evaluative theorists do poorly. Okay, so that's the view in a nutshell and some illustrations of how it's supposed to work. Lots of complicated details we can talk about in Q&A, but that's the basic idea. So I think this kind of partially responds to that challenge that I mentioned before. It's supposed to at least be the beginnings of an explanation of why acting for the sake of a person's good can be a wrong-making feature rather than an uncontroversial right-making feature. And it does seem to draw the distinctions in the right places. It has some, you know, extensional advantages. But it seems to me that a skeptic might be unsatisfied at this point. You might say, look, sure, if we posit the power, if it's true that people have this power, yes, Jonathan, we get the right results. But why think that anybody in fact has it? Right? At the moment, it just seems like a conditional. Why is the antecedent true? And it seems like my objector might say, well, look, what's the deeper rationale for this power? Because it looks like it's a pretty weird one. It seems quite different to our uncontroversial powers. For example, our normal powers of consent with respect to material objects, our powers of promise and command, etc. So in the last 20 minutes or so, have I got 20 minutes, Ray? I didn't take note of what time we started. Okay, cool. 20 minutes, yeah. Okay, so in the last 15 minutes, I'll try and provide some plausible foundations, try and supply something like a rationale the person's having this power in the first place. And the deeper idea is that we try and justify the power by trying to identify some deeper value that's made possible by the possession of the power. Okay. So I'm going to give you three arguments. The first two are what you might call interest-based arguments. So the basic idea is that we can justify rights and powers by trying to show why possessing them is good for the rights or power holder. So in other words, we have rights and powers because they're good for us. The third argument has a slightly different structure. So this argument appeals to the value of intimacy and our kind of interest in having certain kinds of control over certain kinds of relationships with other people. So here's the starting point. I hope reasonably uncontroversial. At least some intimate relationships are good for us. And the idea is that we can justify moral powers by trying to show that they're constituents of certain kinds of valuable relationships, or maybe merely enabling conditions of certain kinds of valuable relationships. So for those of you familiar with Shauna Shiffrin's work on promising, she defends this kind of view. The idea is, well, why do we have the power to promise? Answer, well, promising enables us to have certain kinds of relationships of other people, the relationship of being bound to others. That relationship's valuable. The power makes the value possible. Therefore, we have the power. So I'm kind of appealing to that kind of thought, general strategy. Okay, so here's the next observation. It's often pointed out that certain kinds of valuable relationships have kind of normative stuff as their constituent parts. So it's often argued, for example, that just part of what it is to have a valuable relationship with someone is to be kind of additionally obligated to care for that person's well-being. Right. So there's our general obligations that we have with respect to anybody, just in virtue of the fact they're people. Then there's the people you're friends with. And part of what it is to be friends with them is you have extra reasons or extra obligations even to care for their well-being. Now, I think that's right, but I think that intimate relationships such as friendship, they don't just involve special obligations. They also involve special permissions, permissions that other people don't have. So for example, it seems like friends can ask each other personal questions, which strangers can't. Friends can often use each other's property without their permission in ways that strangers can't. You know, your neighbor can wander into your house and borrow your flower, but well, in some communities, maybe not in Cambridge, but strangers can't. But in general, it seems like your intimates have special permissions to be kind of up in your business in ways that strangers don't. As David Owens nicely puts it, friends have a special license for intimacy. Second observation is the value of this kind of special intimate access to other people's personal domains. The value of it requires at least some measure of exclusivity. So it doesn't just matter that your friends have access to like intimate domains of yours. It matters that your friends have it and other people don't. That's what makes them special. It's the differential access that accounts for at least some of the value of friendship and other, you know, intimate caring relationships. So as David Owens nicely puts it, personal friendship, like family life, is inevitably exclusionary. Sarah's becoming my friend involves our acquiring various habits and emotional propensities through spending time together, engaging in joint activities, and so forth. The activities, the confidences, the peculiar history defining our friendship and its special value can only evolve if we're allowed to exclude others from our friendship, and we can enjoy the friendship once it exists only if we can continue to exclude them. Mere acquaintances shouldn't join us on holiday or try to overhear what we say to each other in a bar. These exclusionary norms are justified by our shared need for someone to matter to us in that special way. I find this view very appealing. So my proposal is that the moral power to control, well, the specific sui generis moral power that I'm positing to control the use of our good is valuable to us, at least partly because it enables a special kind of intimate access. So it's not just access to other people's non-normative domains, but you know, domains constituted by the material world, their bodies, their property, information about them, etc., etc. It's this intimate access to another person's good, to being committed to take their well-being as your end in the way that other people aren't. And my idea is that the value of that special kind of access, this special normative intimacy, requires a measure of exclusivity. The way we make this particular way in which we make special others special to us is by granting them access to our good, which others don't. And the power is necessary for that exclusivity. Just if we didn't have the power, we wouldn't be able to pick out certain people as special to us in this way. We wouldn't be able to create kind of concentric circles of access to our good and to have these more textured relationships. I can say much more about that in the Q&A, but that's the general idea. So this is the claim that there's one distinctive interest we have that's served by this special normative power. Okay, here's another interest-based argument. This one appeals to the role of this moral power in serving our integrity interests rather than our relational interests. So here's the starting point. Again, I hope reasonably banal. We don't like being implicated in things we morally disagree with. And it's valuable for us to be able to divest from contributing to those things. So think about, for example, you know, you find out your pension plan is investing in some industry that you find morally objectionable. It's good for you to have the normative power to kind of control your resources, to withdraw them from contributing to things that you disagree with. So for example, by boycotting, divestment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that ability, this power to control the non-normative world, the material world, is at least partly justified because it serves our interests in integrity, in not being implicated in things which go against our values. Okay, so here's the extension of that thought. I think that we're implicated in other people's actions, not only when we kind of causally or materially contribute to their actions, but we're also in some sense implicated in their actions when they justify their actions by appealing to the fact it would be good for us. In this case, we're normatively implicated in other people's actions rather than causally. You might think this is a bit strange, but I think the clearest example of this is think about the anti-war protest slogan, "Not in my name." And what's interesting is compare that slogan with a more simple slogan, "Don't kill people." Whereas the latter one is agent neutral, it applies to anybody can make that claim intelligibly. The "not in my name" claim is something like, it's not just saying don't do it, it's saying don't do it and justify what you're doing by appealing to me facts, right? Don't put me into contact with your conduct by saying you're doing it for me. Don't appeal to my goods to justify this. And I think the asymmetry between those two ways of objecting to other people's action does show, I think, that this is a fairly kind of familiar part of our moral phenomenology. So here's the proposal. It's valuable to us, I should say us, it's valuable to us to have control over whether we feature in the justification of other people's actions, or maybe just more generally in outcomes that are brought about by others. And the moral power gives us that control that accounts for at least part of its value. So here's an example just to try and hopefully make this as intuitive as possible. So imagine a government proposes to use its powers of eminent domain to forcibly remove people from their homes so their neighborhood can be demolished to make way for a new privately owned shopping center. The government justifies the project by appealing to the fact that the shopping center will create new job opportunities for young people in the city. Now imagine we have two city residents, Tammy and Gina, and they're both deeply morally opposed to the shopping center project. They don't like it at all. Tammy is middle-aged with a good job and a pension, and her pension fund invests heavily in the shopping center operator. Gina, by contrast, is young and unemployed. She pays no taxes and has no investments. So when it comes to Tammy, I think it's fairly clear that she's implicated in the shopping center project in the standard material slash causal way. And because of that, it matters to her. It's valuable for her to be able to engage in practices like boycotting and divestment. It's good for her if she can instruct her pension provider not to invest her pension in the shopping center. So far, so familiar, hopefully. My claim is that Gina is in an analogous situation to Tammy, but the way in which she's implicated in the shopping center project has nothing to do with being kind of causally or materially implicated, right? She has no investments, none of her money is invested in this. The way in which she's implicated is that the government justifies what it's doing by appealing to people like her, saying, look, you're young, you're unemployed, it'd be good for you if we demolish these people's homes and build a shopping center instead. And I think just as it's good for Tammy to be able to control her, her money, her stuff, because it serves her interests and integrity, it's similarly valuable for Gina to be able to control the use of her good by saying, not in my name. And as a result, blocking her good from being available to justify the shopping centre. That's the thought. Okay, and one final argument, which hopefully I've got time for. This is a different kind of argument in terms of its structure. So the idea here isn't that we try and justify our right or power by appealing to the interests of the right or power holder. So the idea is rights don't only protect what is good for persons, what's in their interest. Rather, the thought is that rights can be justified because they reflect the importance of persons, the value of persons, not the value of what is good for persons. So here's a nice quote from Nagel to try and capture the thought. As Nagel puts it, moral status as conferred by moral rights is formally analogous to legal status as conferred by legal rights, except it's not contingent on social practices. It's a universal normative condition, and this is the key part, consisting of what is permitted to be done to persons, what persons are permitted to do, and I think for my purposes, most importantly, what sorts of justifications are required for preventing them from doing what they want, and so forth. So the idea is, certain kinds of rights, or perhaps even just certain kinds of normative phenomena, are justified because they reflect some aspect of the value of persons. Were morality not to contain that normative element, we wouldn't have the moral value that we take ourselves to have. Now, I'll try and give you an argument for the moral power to control the use of one's good, which has the same structure, hopefully a bit less abstract and a bit more tangible. So it starts from the general idea, as I said, that rights don't only protect what is good for persons, but also reflect the moral importance of persons. And the starting point is, I'm sure you'll be familiar with this, a very common criticism of utilitarianism, that it doesn't take seriously the separateness of persons, as Rawls famously put it. On this view, the problem with utilitarianism is that it kind of treats each person as mattering only as a container of welfareist value. And the thought is, well, persons have a more exalted moral status than that. And the right moral theory would be one which contains that missing element. So my proposal is that the right to control the use of one's good is a further reflection of the deeper idea that persons are separate and independent in some relevant sense. So I think we can get to that by reflecting on more familiar separateness of persons type arguments. So here's the most well-known, concerns interpersonal trade-offs. So consider the following example, let's call it burdens. Imagine we have Sally. She's clearly finished paternalizing Barry, and she's back for more. She has a choice between two options. Option one involves imposing 5 units of burden on Bea and bestowing 10 units of burden on the same person, Bea. Option two involves imposing 5 units of burden on Bea, as before, but bestowing 10 units of benefit on a different person, Dana. What's supposed to be the significance of the example? Well, the thought is supposed to be that utilitarianism, at least in its very simple forms, gets the wrong result in cases like this. So a lot of people have a strong intuition that option one is a lot easier to justify than option two. It's a lot easier to justify doing something bad to someone if you also do something good for them as well, than if you do the same bad thing to them, but someone else gets the benefit. They're not compensated for the bad, right? And the idea is that at least simple forms of utilitarianism seem to imply that we should be indifferent between the two, because at the end of the day, you have an extra 5 units of well-being in the world, no matter what you do. Utilitarianism, at least in its very simple forms, doesn't seem to care about where the good is located. It just cares about how much good is done. So as my former colleague Michael Tsuka puts it nicely, it seems to really matter whether a certain quantity of utility falls within the boundary of one person's life or another's. What's supposed to be the upshot of this? Well, take it the thought is that a plausible moral theory must contain a constraint on interpersonal trade-offs. So we care about how much good is done, but we also care about kind of where the good and bads are located and whether one person suffers for another person's benefit or whether they suffer for the sake of their own benefit. A moral theory which ignored the difference between intrapersonal and interpersonal trade-offs would be a kind of moral theory in which our value is reduced to that of a moral receptacle. Doesn't matter who gets benefited, you're just the place where well-being happens, so to speak. Okay. So most people in the separateness of persons debate assume, I think, that the concern for the separateness of persons is kind of exhausted by worries about interpersonal trade-offs. So once we can Once we have a moral theory which has a stringent constraint on interpersonal trade-offs, good, that's a moral theory which fully reflects the separateness of persons. We can move on. So I think that's wrong. I think that kind of additional, I don't know, deontic or normative items are required in a moral theory to fully reflect the separateness of persons' intuition. So here's another case to just try and push that sort of extension forward. It's called this case benefits. So imagine Katie has a choice between two options. Option one involves bestowing 15 units of benefit on herself. Option two involves bestowing 10 units of benefit on a stranger. Okay. What's the problem? Well, I think most people would think that it's perfectly permissible for Katie to do either. If she wants to give someone else a greater benefit than she would bestow on herself, that's totally up to her. Nothing wrong with that. But it looks like utilitarianism, at least in its simple forms, says otherwise, because it looks like Katie kind of gratuitously fails to make the world a better place by giving the smaller benefit away to someone else rather than bestowing a larger benefit on herself. A lot of people think that's a weird implication. And it seems to me that the kind of unintuitive nature of that result stems from the same concern that we looked at in the previous example. It seems to really matter where the good is located. And a theory which doesn't recognize that difference seems to treat us in this more kind of value receptacle-like way. And the thought being we matter more than that. So the thought here is that a plausible moral theory shouldn't just include a constraint on interpersonal trade-offs, as we saw. You need extra stuff. It needs something like an option of suboptimal self-sacrifice. The option to kind of forego larger benefits for oneself for the sake of smaller benefits for others. And note that if Katie was confronting this choice between bestowing the 15 units on one stranger or 10 units on another stranger, it doesn't seem counterintuitive to think that it's permissible for her to maximize the good in that case. What's counterintuitive is that the larger benefit is a benefit to her. So it's picking out the thought that we seem to stand in this special relationship to our own well-being that we don't stand in with respect to others. Okay, all right, almost to the punchline now. So I want to extend that status-based argument for the specific result that I'm interested in, this power to control the use of one's good. So as we saw, the underlying theme behind these examples is that utilitarianism seems to go wrong because it's objectionably location insensitive, doesn't seem to care where well-being happens, just how much happens. The right moral theory should reflect the idea there's a fundamental distinction between my good and yours. So here's the proposal. My claim is that alongside, for example, constraints on interpersonal trade-offs and options of self-sacrifice, we also need the power to control the use of our goods to fully reflect the fact that we're separate and independent. So you don't just need one, you need this kind of tripartite package. So the central thought is that were we to lack that power, and our good was this kind of free-floating resource that anyone could just come along and promote, our status as separate and independent would be diminished in some relevant sense, in the same way that our status would be diminished were there not to be a constraint, special constraint on interpersonal trade-offs, and were we to lack this option of suboptimal self-sacrifice. So just kind of push that forward, consider those public health cases that we started with at the beginning. So my claim is that the best way to explain the difference between these two cases is by positing this sort of sui generis moral power, the power to control whether other people can act for your good or not. Imagine we lacked that power. Well, in that case, morality would be kind of indifferent between whether the Northerners are benefited, the autonomy of the Northerners is infringed for their own sake or for the sake of somebody else. Seems like there'd be this kind of objectionable interchangeability of the people in the examples. In order to avoid that, I think we need to posit something like the power to kind of reflect our status as independent. And one final thing on this is worth pointing out that actually, when you think about it, absent the power to control the use of one's good, it looks like we should conclude that the first public health case should be much easier to justify than the second case. Why is that? Well, it only involves intrapersonal trade-offs, right? We do something bad to the Northerners for their own sake. They're compensated, at least. Sorry I'm doing this to you, but, you know, at least you're spared the illness. In the second case, it's an interpersonal trade-off. And as we saw a few slides ago, there's a strong non-consequentialist intuition that there's a special problem with interpersonal trade-offs that isn't present in the case of intrapersonal. So what my claim is that, kind of reflecting on the foundations of non-consequentialism, like thinking about these sort of separateness of persons type arguments, we actually see that we require not just the constraint on interpersonal trade-offs, which is very familiar in the literature. We also need this special constraint on certain kinds of intrapersonal trade-offs as well. And I think the moral power to control the use of our good kind of captures that thought. Okay, just to sum up then, everybody agrees, I hope, that the wrong of paternalism, strong claim. Everyone agrees that the wrong of paternalism involves treating adults as though they're children in some relevant sense. It seems like the question is, well, what is this kind of a special objectionable sense of treating someone like a child? And I've argued that to treat someone like a child in the relevant sense involves treating them as though they lack a right that they in fact have, the right to control the use of their good. So the key thought is that whereas at least some kinds of children's good, it's kind of normatively accessible to all, adults not only have a good in the way that children do, but they're also sovereign over it. So this is the sense in which I think paternalism offends against a very particular sort of sui generis dimension of our self-sovereignty. Right. Thank you very much.